Welcome to this episode of Onc Live On Air. I'm John Trent. I'm an associate director for clinical research, and I lead the sarcoma group at Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center in Miami, Florida. And I'm delighted today to be joined by my colleague, Dr. Nita Somaya.
Hi, all. I'm Dr. Nita Somaya. I am a professor and the chair of the Sarcoma Medical Oncology Group at University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. And it's a pleasure to be here with John.
Great to have you here, Nita. In today's episode, we'll be discussing the potential role of circulating tumor DNA or ctDNA testing in gastrointestinal stromal tumor or GIST, as well as the importance of identifying both initial drivers of disease and secondary resistance mechanisms when approaching treatment sequencing and selection.
We appreciate you joining us for today's lively discussion, and we're going to dive right in. So I'll ask the first question of John. So as a rare malignancy, what are some of the unique challenges and unmet needs associated with the management of GIST?
Yeah, that's a great question. And GIST is rare. There's maybe somewhere around 4,000 to 5,000 new patients diagnosed in the entire US. So it's a very rare disease. And even in the era of molecular testing, there still is some misdiagnosis occasionally. So we generally recommend as a foundational step to have a sample of the biopsy or surgical specimen reviewed at a sarcoma reference center by an experienced sarcoma pathologist. In addition to that, if there's some possibility that the patient is going to be treated with a systemic therapy, or there's some possibility there might be a hereditary syndrome, we generally recommend that GIST patients undergo next generation sequencing or some other test to identify the driver mutation in the tumor. I would consider those really the first steps in a patient's journey with GIST. And it's surprising that in the U.S. even today, many GIST patients do not get this mutation testing that's really critical for treatment.
Yeah, I agree. And I think access to expert centers, while it's increasing, and even the mutation testing availability has increased significantly, it's still not universal. So totally agree.
So let me ask you, Nita, which primary driver mutations are most clinically relevant in GIST, and how do they shape frontline therapy in your practice?
Right. So when we talk about primary driver mutations in GIST, I would say about 80% of patients, 70 to 80%, will have a driver alteration in the gene called KIT, which then leads to an abnormality in the KIT receptor. And most of those alterations are usually present in the location of exon 11, the juxtamembrane location. I would say approximately 60 to 70% are in exon 11 alterations, and around 9% would be exon 9 in terms of primary mutation. So exon 11, exon 9, KIT make majority of GIST driver alterations in the primary setting. There are 1% of cases that might have a primary driver in exon 13 or exon 17 in the KIT gene. We also have PDGFR, which accounts for around 5 to 8% of primary driver alterations. So it's very important to check for those, to detect those less common driver alterations. I would say around 10 to 15% might not have KIT or PDGFR driver alterations. So that's where a more broader next-gen sequencing approach is helpful to identify rarer alterations like BRAF and NTRK. But most of those in that 10 to 15% will boil down to what we classify as SDH deficient GIST, either driven by SDH mutations in SDH ABCD, or methylation changes that lead to suppression of SDHB. So that's what I'd classify as primary drivers when we talk about sequencing in the frontline setting for GIST.
Let me just follow up on that. Do you think there is a GIST that has no mutations or epigenetic repression of SDH? Do you think that that tumor exists, or do you think that there's always going to be either some type of driver, whether it's epigenetic repression of SDH or one of the mutations or translocations we've discussed today?
So it's interesting because when we were looking, so there are, when we look at our data set, there are some patients whom we were not able to identify any driver mutations in broad spectrum panels. We also did not identify S, so the SDHB was retained on immunohistochemistry, pointing to probably no, no suppression of SDH or SDH pathway alterations. So I think there exists a subset of GISTs where we have yet not identified the driver, but that is a small subset. We talked about this as being quadruple negative GIST or how, where we weren't able to identify the driver. So I think that exists. It's rare. That is, I would say, even in the whole like non-KIT, non-PDGFR altered GIST remains to be an unmet need. And those small subset of patients where we don't have a driver alteration are even more challenging sometimes to treat, especially when they have advanced disease. But it's important to do this testing up front because, the selection imatinib is the frontline standard therapy right now, but there are some subsets where we would not be selecting this up front. So it's important to check.
My opinion is that most of the GISTs where we don't find a driver really do have a driver. It's just our technical limitations that are, any test has a false positive or false negative. So that's kind of what I think, but there could be out there. I mean, I think the important message is that don't stop at KIT and PDGFR. You've got to look for the quadruple zebra or whatever you're looking for. GISTs are zebra diagnosis, but there's so many subtypes of GIST. We got to just keep looking until you've really exhausted all possible approaches, because you can, like, recently described FGFR translocation. Who would have thought of that a few years ago? So.
And to your point, it's also important if someone had a test a long time ago and is all negative, it is probably important to recheck in the newer panels available because as they broaden the panels, we're finding more alterations. So, correct. So, okay, I'm going to go on and ask you the next question. So, resistance to first-line imatinib is common over time in advanced GIST. So, what are the dominant molecular mechanisms underlying that progression?
Yeah, that's a really important question that you bring up. And this topic is really timely with all the new studies and new agents that are in the pipeline for patients with advanced GIST. First line treatment's imatinib, and it's a decent drug. We borrowed it from CML. It's not a GIST specific drug, and now we have all these new agents in development that are being created specifically for GIST patients. And a lot of this is driven by the resistance mutations. At least in our practice, when we look for resistance mutations by ctDNA, we can find them usually in 70% to 80% of patients, maybe a little higher if we're selective. But these resistance mutations are the most common mechanism. There's probably other mechanisms such as P-glycoprotein and the ABC transporters and some salt pumps that prevent drugs from getting into tumor cells. But the most common resistant mechanism are these secondary or resistance mutations that occur typically in regions that the kinase inhibitor imatinib and other ones are binding. And those mutations are typically in the ATP pocket or the A loop, and those are the areas where imatinib binds. And so we see those mutations either in KIT exon 13, the ATP binding pocket, or in exon 17, the A loop. And these mutations render the kinase resistant to imatinib so that it can stay in the activated conformation. And so those would be the major resistance mutations. Usually it's one or the other, especially at the beginning after imatinib, but later in therapy, you can see heterogeneity in terms of perhaps a liver nodule has an exon 13 resistance and a peritoneal nodule has an exon 17 resistance. And then you can also see these APAL resistance mutations that are on the same allele in the same cancer cell. And it's not really clear if there's any active therapy against those. And I really think that's in some work that Sebastian Bauer and other people are doing are pointing towards that being an important mutation to be able to identify in the future.
Correct. Now I'll ask you a follow-up question to that, but do you think the therapies that we use, do we see different heterogeneity or spectrum of mutations appear based on the type of TKI we use, or is it just with subsequent lines of therapy?
That's also a timely question. There's some studies that are trying to answer that from different approaches. And so what's emerged in vitro data, in clinical experience, initially was that exon 13 resistance mutations in a patient with for instance, an exon 11 or even an exon 9 primary mutation may get an exon 13 resistance mutation that would be relatively sensitive to sunitinib treatment, but relatively resistant to other treatments such as regorafenib and ripretinib. Now, the patients who develop exon 17 resistance mutation would be would have a tumor expressing that resistance that would be resistant to an exon 13 inhibitor like sunitinib, but could be sensitive to regorafenib, ripretinib, and some other agents that are like the newer bezuclastinib that is targeting exon 17 resistance mutations. And we looked at our data of about 150 GIST patients a few years ago and found that these occur in patients after imatinib therapy and they persist after subsequent lines of therapy. And that, in fact, if you treat patients based on their ctDNA results, you end up with a better outcome than would be expected in the absence of ctDNA testing. And so there's some studies looking at this prospectively. So on that note, with multiple TKIs available in later lines, how important is mutation profiling for informing sequencing strategies of your therapies, Nita, in your practice?
Well, it's actually getting, it is very important. And I think the importance is getting heightened with newer agents available that are able to target these emerging resistance mechanisms even better. So you actually highlighted very well. So you helped me answer some of this question is when you look at second line availability of agents, historically, we've used sunitinib in the second line setting, which works well against exon 13 and 14 mutations, the ATP binding pocket alterations, and then therapies in the third and fourth line, which are available, which is regorafenib and ripretinib, are more effective in the activation loop, which is exon 17 and 18 mutations. And as we're understanding, so when patients progress on imatinib, of course, there's a whole spectrum. So sometimes patients might have just exon 13 alterations or basically ATP binding alterations or activation loop alterations. And there are some patients they might have actually both because there is heterogeneity across their different metastasis sites. So it becomes really important in knowing that what is the driver of that progression. So profiling strategies are not only important in the front line because it's important to know if they might have a primary resistance alterations such as PDGFR D842V, where we will not use imatinib, And but it's also now becoming increasingly important in the setting of progression on imatinib. If we have sequencing known that what is driving the progression, we can pick an agent that is most likely going to control the disease better in that second line. So if you look at our historic data, the first trial that got sunitinib approved, the response rates were around, if I recall, in the 5% range, which even a PFS was in that 5-month range. Of course, later data has shown with the INTRIGUE study that sunitinib, when used, now that we have more experience using it, the response rates can be a little bit higher, and the PFS is around in the 8-month range. Now, if we actually take in the INTRIGUE study, when they did the analysis of looking at patients who had ctDNA, because the INTRIGUE study was patients were randomized between ripretinib and sunitinib in the second line setting, and these were patients where we did not know their resistance mechanism prior to enrollment, but ctDNA data was collected at the time of enrollment. And exploratory analysis after, even though the primary intention to treat analysis subset did not show a difference between PFS between ripretinib and sunitinib, when we looked at the exploratory cohorts, when patients had an exon 11 plus 13 or 14 alterations, actually sunitinib outperformed ripretinib. And similarly, when we looked at the exon 11 plus 17, 18 population, ripretinib far outperformed sunitinib with a response rate of 44% versus zero in that subset, and a PFS that was also, I think, 14 months versus a couple of months with sunitinib. So it tells us that choosing the drug that is right in that second line setting can make a big difference for a patient's outcome, and might result in a significant response, might even make some of these patients resectable if their disease responds that well in that second line setting. So I think mutation profiling is very important for informing subsequent lines of therapy, and it's going to get even more important as we see, I think we might discuss later about the newer, trials that are being reported with Sutent and bezuclastinib, and then we'll have, newer agents like IDRx. And I think sequencing therapies is now going to be, we should personalize it even more. We used to choose them as, in line, but we used to look at side effect profile. We'd look at the patient's mutation profile, but not as importantly as we will right now, because choosing the right therapy or in order, with all these agents available is going to be critically important.
So let's say you get your ctDNA result or a biopsy or whatever, and you find that there is equal amounts of allele fraction of the AP and the AL. So exon 13 and 17 resistant seem to be appearing simultaneously. We don't know if it's cis allelic. We don't know if it's intercellular. So with that knowledge and what we have today in our arsenal, what treatment would you recommend?
Firstly, if I had a clinical trial, there is a trial available with IDRx 42, which is velzatinib, I think, if I'm saying it correct, versus sunitinib, that is a potential option because we know that and crossover is allowed, and I know velzatinib has a broader mutation spectrum and might cover some of both. But prior to that, I think we have data that was reported, and we're going to hear more at ASCO 2026, is the Sutent plus bezuclastinib combination therapy that is currently available only through the expanded access platform. But if you look at the alterations that that combination covers, the reason we see a great PFS and response rate is because of the broad spectrum coverage with that combination, where Sutent is covering the ATP binding alteration, ATP binding pocket alterations well, and the bezuclastinib has really good coverage for the exon, the activation loop alterations. So I think currently, if I was presented with a patient like that, I would prioritize the expanded access study that we have ongoing versus the IDRx, or the Strategist 3 study, which is the phase 3 study of Sutent versus velzatinib.
This is just something I was thinking. In general, in sarcoma, I learned from Bob Benjamin that you start with the most effective therapy because there are a small subset of patients that are cured. It's definitely in first line with imatinib. There's metastatic patients alive 25 years later. So I bet in second line, now that we're getting more effective therapies, we may be able to effectively cure patients with the most effective therapy. So to me, that's somewhat compelling for the exon 13 resistant patient, exon 17 resistant patient, and also for the 13 plus 17. Maybe we should be treating them all with bezuclastinib plus sunitinib because that exon 13 resistant patient probably has some 17 clones in there that we're not detecting yet. And why not try to eradicate them as early as we can and give the patient that chance for longer term survival?
I completely agree with you that the most effective therapy should be used up front. But also, sometimes everything that you see on even ctDNA. So I'll tell you, I had a patient on the PEAK study actually had an exon 17 alteration identified. And I was really nervous because the patient caught I randomized to sunitinib. So I was like, okay, we've got to do the scan really quick. Once we got the scan, the patient actually responded to sunitinib. Surprisingly, he was on sunitinib for 9 months, and then went on to progress. And then I put the patient, not 9 or maybe 7 months, I might be getting that incorrect, but and then went on to the combination, had a great response, and is actually one of the longest on the PEAK study. So that being said, that's the thing for clinical trials. I am a proponent for doing the right trial and choosing the right patient for a trial, but by all means, I think a broader coverage upfront is better, which is why I think drugs like IDRx that have broad coverage, the Sutent bezuclastinib with broad coverage, will become the second line choice of drugs because you can't predict, even if you have an exon 17, who might have an underlying 13 with them or vice versa, because it's not just detected that well. So I think broad coverage, right drug, but we also have to take into account, side effects. So for example, with Incyte, right? If someone has just an exon 17 or an exon 11 plus 17, and they don't do very well on a Sutent of any, in any dosing, even if you reduce the dose, ripretinib, if approved, might be the right choice in that second line setting because they can go a long time with just that combination. Also, the bulk of disease, sometimes if you have low volume metastases with a single alteration, we might make a judgment based on that. Whatever gets the patient to the best response so we can kind of target treat the remaining disease and keep them alive for the longest.
One last question. Which investigational agents and upcoming randomized trials do you think are most likely to further refine our precision sequencing strategies in GIST?
So I think, and I'll put the question back to you, but I think the velzatinib, the Sutent bezuclastinib, of course, ripretinib is available, but at the second line, I think there is another drug called NB003 that we haven't talked about that is interesting because there's some mutations that are not covered by the rest where this drug still has activity and might be further studied in potentially the third line setting. So we'll see data with that emerging.
And the non-TKIs, like the menin inhibitor plus TKI, the autophagy inhibitor, DCC-3116, those are all encouraging. But I think it's going to depend on how good they are at both exon 13 and 17, because the combination bezuclastinib plus sunitinib is really effective at both and reasonably well tolerated. So they're going to have to beat that, I think. That's my thought.
I agree. And then, maybe some of the other drugs, if the pathway of resistance is not one of the secondary alterations sometimes and something else, maybe those combinations will be more effective in keeping the frontline disease controlled for longer. But we'll have to see. And there are other, the MTAP, deficient GIST, there's a lot of subsets that are being investigated. And it would be interesting to see how we have to incorporate those into our treatment paradigm, upfront or later on. But it's an exciting time overall for GIST, I think. So, which is good.
Yeah, the patients are having more and more options. So it's really, really remarkable compared to pre-TKI when patients only lived about 9 months.
Exactly. And I think in summary, I think we both agree, John and I, that checking mutation testing in the primary setting, extremely important, whether on tumor, if tumor not available, then ctDNA. And then at the time of progression from imatinib or progression on imatinib, it is now critical to get ctDNA testing done to identify these alterations. In subsequent lines, again, it depends if we think there are some alleles that might be more expressed because you've treated with one subset to identify them at the time of progression on TKIs can be used. But currently, at least those two settings should be prioritized.
I agree with everything you say. I suspect a very small percentage of GIST patients are really getting ctDNA testing at progression, and I hope the results of these exciting studies continue to increase that.
Fantastic. Well, I think that's all we have for this episode on OncLive on Air. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in. And we hope you have found our discussion to be useful and available for your clinical practice.